From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, a court finds the Netherlands responsible for the deaths of 300 Muslim men and boys after Dutch peacekeepers failed to protect them during the 1995 Srebrenica massacre.
People were killed, executed, and then put in mass graves, a number of mass graves that are scattered across the region in eastern Bosnia.
Also today, an interview with the late Alice Coachman-Davis, the first black female to win Olympic gold. And we talk to a correspondent in Israel as the deadly offensive in Gaza intensifies.
Both Netanyahu and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas have really been two significant casualties of the Gaza war. I mean, there's the death toll and the injured, and then there's also the political casualties.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. A Dutch court has ruled that the Netherlands bears responsibility for the deaths of more than 300 Muslims in Srebrenica in 1995. The massacre, the worst in Europe since the Second World War, occurred after Muslims sheltering with Dutch peacekeepers were ordered to leave a UN compound. Former BBC war correspondent Martin Bell says it's important to remember all the victims of the war, those who died at Srebrenica, and those who perished elsewhere.
The peoples of Europe have to learn that this kind of thing can happen because of the hatred we can have in our own hearts. And until the hatred is gone and we find other ways of settling our differences, there was always the risk that what happened here can happen somewhere else.
Two workers with the Moscow underground system have been arrested following Tuesday's train derailment that claimed 22 lives. The investigation into what caused the accident continues. From FSN's bureau in Moscow, Jake Rashbass reports.
Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyanin declared the day after the accident a day of mourning throughout the city, and Muscovites have been bringing flowers to the two stations in between which the train derailed. Flags have been lowered around the city, and cultural events and festivities which were planned to take place today are reported to have been cancelled. The exact cause of the accident remains unknown, but Russia's investigative committee has ruled out a terror attack. It seems there was a technological fault, and Mayor Sobyanin has expressed that those responsible will be found and prosecuted. Jake Rashbass, Moscow.
Britain's National Crime Agency has arrested 660 suspected paedophiles following a six-month operation targeting people accessing child abuse images online. Those arrested include former police officers, youth leaders, teachers, and doctors. The agency says more than 400 children have been protected as a result of the operation. British Prime Minister David Cameron welcomed news of the arrests.
Well, I think what these figures, what these arrests show is that the National Crime Agency, which this government set up, is now up and running and doing a very good job at bringing all the modern methods of policing and technology to go after the perpetrators of a particularly horrible crime.
Palestinian officials say the death toll in the Gaza Strip has risen above 200 as Israel and Hamas continue their military assault on each other's territory. Four Palestinian children were killed in an airstrike on a beach near Gaza City on Wednesday. Diplomatic attempts to end the conflict have failed. Time Warner has rejected a takeover bid from 21st Century Fox. Analysts say the $80 billion bid by Rupert Murdoch's company was made last month. 21st Century Fox says no additional talks are underway with Time Warner at the moment. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A British grandmother facing a death sentence in Indonesia for drug smuggling has lost an appeal in Britain against government policy. Lindsay Sandiford wanted the British government to be legally obliged to pay for her lawyer. From FSN's London bureau, Tom Barton reports.
57-year-old Sandiford from Cheltenham was found with an estimated $2,700,000 worth of cocaine when she arrived in Bali on a flight from Bangkok in May 2012. Sandiford says she was forced to take the drugs because her children's safety was at stake. The UK government does not provide legal aid for Britons in criminal proceedings abroad, even if they face the death penalty. The Supreme Court have upheld the Court of Appeal's verdict that the government's policy was lawful. Sandiford is due to be shot as a result of her January 2013 conviction. Tom Barton, London.
Manuel Noriega, the former dictator of Panama, has filed a lawsuit against the publisher of the video game Call of Duty. He says that the game depicts him as a kidnapper and an enemy of the state, and he's seeking damages, as FSN's Andrea Arenas reports.
In the game, a character named Manuel Noriega, who looks like the real former Panamanian military dictator, assists the CIA and then betrays the U.S. intelligence agency. The video game plot follows real events back in the 1980s, when Manuel Noriega became a close U.S. ally until Washington grew concerned about his violent ways and cut ties with Panama. This, in the U.S. legal system, individuals have the right to publicity and control over how they are depicted commercially, which lawyers say includes video games. However, Manuel Noriega is not a U.S. citizen or a resident, making his legal claim against Activision more questionable. Andrea Arenas, Washington.
There's more from us on Twitter. You can interact with us there at Feature Story. And that is the latest Feature Story news. Simon Marks reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. A Dutch court at The Hague ruled Wednesday that the Netherlands is responsible for the deaths of 300 Muslim Bosnian men and boys after UN peacekeepers from the country failed to protect them during the Srebrenica massacre in 1995. The Dutch state has now been ordered to compensate the victims' families. However, the court did clear the Netherlands of liability in the massacre of nearly 8,000 other Bosniaks. Balkans analyst Shretko Latal discussed the ruling with me earlier.
In July 1995, July 11th, was the day when the enclave, the UN protective enclave of Srebrenica, fell to the Serb forces. It was the day when the UN peacekeepers in Srebrenica failed to protect people who were there. And as a result, more than 9,000 or 10,000 people were killed, executed, and put in mass graves, a number of mass graves that are scattered across the region in eastern Bosnia. What we have heard happening today was the first instance court ruling of the Hague Court, which found that the Dutch peacekeepers are to be blamed for not protecting a group of Bosniaks who were gathered in Potočari in the U.S. Base. And from what I heard from people from Srebrenica, from survivors, it is obvious that they are not fully satisfied with this court decision, because essentially this court decision has split the Srebrenica survivors in three groups, and it has found the Dutch battalion guilty only for not protecting the group of people who were at the UN camp, and at the same time the court found the Dutch battalion not to be responsible for the exodus and the massacre of people who were outside of their camp. So what I could say is that this was a pretty much expected decision. I mean, first of all, what I would like to say is that, what we should definitely wait for is the final ruling, because this decision, from what I gather, will be appealed probably by both sides. And I think, having in mind how highly disputed this decision is, I think that first and foremost we should maybe wait for the final analysis for the appeal process to be finalized, and for the verdict to be final.
You mentioned the scale of this massacre. You know, we're talking about thousands and thousands of men and boys killed, and yet today the case centered on just 300 of those deaths in Srebrenica. Can you explain why these victims are being divided like this?
The decision was related only to a group of people who were in the camp and in the UN camp in Potočari, and not to all the Bosniaks who were in Srebrenica enclave. So essentially the court, it seems to me, some sort of a compromise where they found a Dutch battalion responsible only for people within their camp, but not for the people who were outside of the camp. On the other hand, what the lawyers for the victims and what the victims' associations are claiming is that this was the Srebrenica was declared UN safe haven, and that UN and therefore Dutch battalion that was in charge of it was responsible for security of all people in that enclave.
Sretko Natal. And we'll be returning to the Srebrenica massacre at the end of the show in FSN Spotlight. This is FSN Reports.
We are concerned about reports of loss of life on both sides of the border. That's why we have encouraged Israeli and Palestinian leaders to try to resolve the situation.
The White House once again urging Hamas militants to agree a ceasefire with Israel as the conflict intensifies. The Israeli army warned tens of thousands of civilians to leave northern Gaza as airstrikes were ramped up in the Palestinian territory. Senior Israeli officials are now warning that a ground invasion is very likely. Over 200 people have now died, including four children playing on a beach in Gaza. Krista Case Bryant is Israel Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor.
From the Israeli side, you know, for the past few days, there have been people, particularly on the right wing, who are saying, look, Hamas is encouraging people to act as human shields, to not leave their homes, to purposely get killed, basically, to try to build up international sympathy for the Palestinian cause. And it just proves that they have a culture of death and martyrdom that stands in stark distinction to our valuing of life. But from what I understand from my Gaza colleague, he said, it's not that straightforward. There have been statements that have been construed in that way by the Israelis, but what they were mainly talking about, as far as he understood, was that these robocalls to homes in the northern Gaza Strip were seen as a psychological tactic to try to scare the Gaza people, and Hamas was encouraging people not to take them seriously because they didn't think, they didn't believe that Israel would actually follow up with strikes or with an invasion. So I think, as with many things in the Middle East, the truth probably lies somewhere in the middle of that. But last I heard, there was not a mass evacuation of those areas despite the warnings. And I think part of that is because Gaza is a pretty densely populated area as it is, and it's just difficult to move something like 200,000 people to a different part of the territory.
Palestinian sources put the number of dead in Gaza at 211, obviously a number that keeps rising. The United Nations says the majority of those have been civilians.
Yes, well, one thing, first of all, is I was doing some comparison with the casualties in the previous conflict in November 2012, which lasted 8 days, and yesterday was the eighth day of this operation. Although that did include, I think, about 6 hours of Israel withholding any airstrikes. But still, at the end of the eighth day, this time, the casualties were about 20% higher, by my calculation, than in the last conflict. And it's very, very difficult to see the images that are coming out of Gaza, especially of the children involved.
And Krista, do you have a sense of the pressure in Israel on Prime Minister Netanyahu to go in on the ground? I mean, we saw yesterday that he actually sacked his deputy defense minister, which was related to this very issue.
Yes. So all along Netanyahu, I mean, even before the escalation with Gaza, Netanyahu was coming under significant pressure, both from the public and from his opponents, political opponents, and also people within his own party to crack down on Palestinian violence much more strongly. And first, that was in response to the kidnapping of the three Israeli teenagers. He took a lot of flack for not cracking down in a more serious way, especially once the bodies were found. And then, again, with this escalation, he's come under pressure to launch more airstrikes or to launch a ground invasion because it's widely considered impossible to wipe out Hamas's rocket capabilities without a ground invasion. And the firing of Danny Danon yesterday, Danone is part of this rising young guard within the Likud party that is increasingly challenging Netanyahu and trying to say that he's a weak leader and he's not what Israel needs at this time. And those that younger guard is becoming much more bold in its statements. They don't even pretend to support a two-state solution. And Netanyahu does face a challenge from that regard. One thing that's worth noting here is that both Netanyahu and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas have really been two significant casualties of the Gaza war. I mean, there's the death toll and the injured, and then there's also the political casualties. And I think both of them are facing increased criticism from more hardline members of their respective spheres because of the restraint that they've shown over the past few weeks.
Krista Case Bryant is Israel Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. Now, the first black woman to win Olympic gold, Alice Coachman Davis, passed away this week at the age of 90. The track star, who was known for training in her bare feet on dirt roads, won her first high jump championship at just 16. She went on to win gold in the high jump at the 1948 London Olympics. Here she recounts the moment she realised she'd won in an interview with the National Visionary Leadership Project.
When I saw it on the board, A. Coachman, USA, number one. He told me that one of the officials came over and told me, Mr. Coachman, come on, go to the podium. I didn't know what was going on. I went on, stood up there, and they started playing the national anthem. It was wonderful to hear.
Did you figure it out then? When they started playing the national anthem?
Yeah, because what I had gone through before that. My coach had cussed me out before the meet. Told me, you sit up here, you're going to be just like the rest of them. All the rest of the girls had failed. There was not a second place there. There wasn't a first place. This is in track and field now. I'm not talking about swimming and the other thing. Everyone had failed. We had a third place there and a fourth place. But the fast girls that we had here that went over were just like little babies standing still among blank of corn and the rest of them. And I was the last one, the last hope. And when we got there, August the 7th, she wanted me to work out the day before, and I wouldn't. And she laid it on me that day. You gonna be just like the rest of them. Sit around here, you ain't going nowhere, and you gonna come up with nothing. And the man in there massaging me down, getting me ready for that England weather, and it was dreary that day too. And she just paging up and down, up and down, up and down. And I need to work out yesterday. I said, I don't work out on the day before my meet. Oh, she's just fussing. I just let her fuss. All she wanted to fuss. I understood her because I was on the All-American team for 3 years. And I was the only black on that team. And I had to go with her, with that All-American team, to Montreal. So I was with her, I understood her. I let her do all her preaching and all her fussing. But I was talking to the man above, telling him, if it's your will, let it be done.
Alice Coachman Davis in a 2010 interview for the National Visionary Leadership Project. And finally tonight, it's FSN Spotlight. Here's Simon Marks.
On FSN Spotlight today, looking back at the war in the former Yugoslavia through the eyes of a man who chronicled it. As we reported earlier in the programme, a Dutch court has ruled that the Netherlands bears responsibility for the deaths of some of the 7,000 Muslims massacred in Srebrenica in 1995. Martin Bell is a former BBC correspondent whose reports on the war in the former Yugoslavia captivated audiences in the UK and and overseas. And on a recent visit to Bosnia-Herzegovina, he told Amina Pajalia of the local television station TV1 that it's important to remember all the victims of the war, those who died at Srebrenica and those who perished elsewhere.
I think it is important to remember all the mass crimes, not just the worst, but all the others as well. And when I give my speeches, when I was in Parliament and talking about this great country, one of the points I would make was there was no monopoly of evil and no monopoly of suffering. But terrible things happened, and numerically, the worst of all was Srebrenica. And I think the peoples of Europe have to learn that this kind of thing can happen because of the hatred we can have in our own hearts. And until the hatred is gone and we find other ways of settling our differences, there was always the risk that what happened here can happen somewhere else.
At a time when you reported about the war in Bosnia and Herzegovina, you were not in Srebrenica because access to the Serbian territory was denied. To what extent to the recording of execution of men committed by the Scorpions was contributed to change or to changing the consciousness of the world about what happened in Srebrenica?
Unfortunately, we were denied access to Republika Srpska from August 1994. So when it came to 95 and all those people disappeared, we could only guess. But you can't base a television report on guesswork. And therefore, it was slow to come out. We suspected the worst when we saw the satellite photographs of the earth moving in and around Srebrenica. And then, of course, slowly the truth came out. And those who wished to deny it, denied it, up until the time when the damning video was produced, which you referred to by the Scorpions, which is absolutely unwatchable. It's so horrible. It's a systematic, hellish roadside execution. But it was introduced as evidence in the tribunal in The Hague. And from that point on, all realistic denial went away, though it is still attempted. You know, the evidence is there.
What was the role of foreign media during the war in Bosnia and Herzegovina? Which are Bosnian politicians you have cooperated with? Maybe you talk about some of them in your book. With whom of them have you actively cooperated, and what can you say about their role during the war from this distance now, 20 years ago?
From this distance now, I think the foreign media seems more important than it did at the time. At the time, I was putting into the public domain these terrible images all over of suffering peoples. And my country, my government, the people cared, but the government seemed not to. And to the shame of the international community, we took token actions like escorting food convoys, like declaring the safe areas, like setting up the international court. But I said all along, and I wrote at the time, we could have ended it sooner. The politicians, I liked them, actually. Obviously, we spent a lot of time with Haris Silajic on this side. On the other side, I saw Radovan Karadzic very regularly. He was personally helpful. And so was his deputy, Nikola Koljevic, who tragically shot himself at the time of the Dayton Agreement. So it's not as if we courted the politicians only on one side. We needed them for access. I even got on with the notorious Arkan, the leading paramilitary, because he gave you access to things, and he too met a bad end. But if you only, as a journalist, especially in time of war, if you only talk to people you like, you're not going to get very far.
You met Mladic and Karadzic during the war. What is your experience, and what can you say about this experience?
I met Mladic not often. I did on one occasion try to prevent him strangling in the airport. Kurt Schork, the Reuters correspondent, and Nikola Koljevic he appealed to me to calm my friend down. I said, "I'll calm down my friend if you'll calm down yours." Karadzic we saw a lot up until we were excluded. And then I never saw him again he called me. He wrote a tract called My Defense, in which he called John Burns of the New York Times, Christian Amanpour of CNN, and myself. He called us media monstrosities. Then when I gave evidence in his case 2 years ago, he asked to see me in his guarded cell, and I did. And he could not have been more affable. And in open court, he called me a precious witness. So, you know, I got to know these people fairly well. One of the advantages from a journalistic point of view is that it was so difficult to get here and so dangerous to live here that there were not that many of us here, even especially at the height of the war. So you weren't dealing with spin doctors and press officers. You were dealing with the main players, with Karadzic, with Salajic, with Izet Begovic, with Tihomir Blaskic, the Croat general in central Bosnia, and of course with all the United Nations commanders.
Well, there were rather often efforts to impose the thesis that it was a civil war rather than the aggression against Bosnia and Herzegovina. How is your comment, or how would you comment this?
Arkan and his tigers ethnically cleansed Zvornik in early April 1992. The beginning of the end of the war was the attack by main force Croatian units in 1995. I mean, in the realistic world, I don't think foreign powers were going to stay out. I think the tragedy was that the foreign powers who intervened were the local ones, Serbia, Croatia, and the foreign powers who held up their hands and said it's none of our business were the Western democracies. And I think the blame for this terrible war rests not only with those who did and directed the fighting, but also with those governments like my government, which allowed it to happen.
What do you think about the role of the international community during the war in Bosnia and Herzegovina?
I think the role of the international community initially was shameful. There was no international community when it broke out, except, of course, the headquarters of UNPROFOR. But after they were blitzed out, they beat a hasty retreat, and there was no one left but the international press. And then the United Nations and the European community then embarked on a series of token interventions, like the declaration of the safe areas when negotiation failed, and then the fighting just intensified. And looking back at it historically, I think that what made the difference tragically, it could have been ended so quickly.
You have reported actually from 18 battlefields. Can you compare your experience in Bosnia and Herzegovina with the other war zones you have been?
I think for all of us, this war affected us more than, you know, I started in Vietnam, for heaven's sake. This war affected us more than any other we'd ever been in, partly because we were so close to the suffering of so many people, partly because we love the country and its people, all its peoples. You know, I had some very good friends in Republika Srpska, and I hope I still do. And we were marked by it. We took quite a lot of casualties. I lost a very dear friend of mine, a Croatian cameraman, blown away near Jajce on All Souls Day 1993. So I wasn't here, but last year on the 20th anniversary, there was a great in-gathering, 100 or 200 of the journalists who were here. They wouldn't have done that for any other country in the world. We all feel, and I'm sure I speak for all of us, that this is a very special place with very special people.
Martin Bell, formerly with the BBC, talking there to Emina Pajalia of Bosnian television station TV1. After the war, Martin Bell became a member of the British Parliament, sitting as an independent from 1997 until 2001. Today, he's a UNICEF ambassador, and he regularly writes and lectures about the state of journalism and the coverage of global conflicts. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the programme by emailing us reports@featurestory.com and follow us on Twitter. We're there @featurestory. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside Simon Marks on the bulletin desk. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.